I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
U.S. Undersecretary of State John Bolton is in Geneva, Switzerland today, meeting with officials from the G8 countries. It's a prelude to next week's meeting in Vienna of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Bolton's goal? To convince European allies that Iran is violating international rules and is trying to build a nuclear bomb. Well, joining us on the line from London is Stephen Fiedler, chief reporter for the Financial Times. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you.
So as you report, this is the sixth time that the 35 countries on the IAEA board are getting together and try to figure out what to do about Iran's nuclear program. Put it simply, what does everyone want Iran to do?
Well, I suppose those countries who are most concerned want it to suspend enrichment of uranium. I think the Americans, who are very worried about this, think probably even a suspension of a uranium enrichment program would not be enough, because they suspect that Iran has a clandestine program underneath all this that's not known about by the rest of the world. So they're looking for even tougher action to get the Iranians to stop.
And, of course, the Iranians are saying, well, we're doing this for peaceful purposes, for nuclear energy. What is the evidence of Iran's nuclear intentions?
Well, the evidence that we have in the public domain really doesn't tell you what its intentions are. Certain parts of the nuclear cycle can be used either to manufacture fuel for a nuclear energy reactor or can be used for a nuclear weapon. And all that's been discovered in Iran so far could be used for either purposes.
And do we know what might be necessary to get Iran to change its behavior? It's sort of one step forward, one step back, a couple of steps sideways. You know, how can Iran be persuaded to change?
Well, the three European governments have been trying to persuade it. That's France, Britain and Germany have been trying to persuade it with some economic incentives to voluntarily suspend its uranium enrichment program. That's probably the most concrete idea to have emerged. I think the U.S. would like to take a much more punishment-oriented approach and get sanctions based from the UN Security Council against Iran for trying to hide this enrichment program in the past. I think a bunch of other countries would probably like the whole issue to go away.
And what might happen if this is taken to the UN? Could that backfire?
Well, it could backfire in a number of ways. One, in the first sense, that it's possibly unlikely that the UN Security Council could get agreement on sanctions for Iran that the U.S. wants. But more importantly, it's also possible that Iran might do what North Korea did some time ago, and that is withdraw from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which it can do with 6 months' notice. And if it did that, then it would be perfectly entitled, legally anyway, to go ahead and develop nuclear weapons.
So, Stephen, it sounds as if neither carrots or sticks are working here.
That's true. I think people are looking. I think that probably most people, or at least a consensus view, would be that Iran is wants to develop its nuclear capabilities to the point that it has a nuclear weapons option, but perhaps not to develop nuclear weapons, you know, completely. So that it's something that it might be able to take off the shelf in the future, if it wanted to.
And is Israel the closest neighbor who has reason to really be concerned about Iran developing nuclear weapons?
Well, I think that possibly the nearest neighbor would be Saudi Arabia. And there's the whole concern about Iran having a nuclear capability is that there would be a kind of domino effect in the Middle East, and that people like the traditional competitors and rivals such as the Saudis would also feel it necessary to develop a nuclear weapon. So it's not only Israel, but also some of the Arab states around Iran that would feel concerned.
Well, what's your best guess as to what's going to happen here? Do you think it's going to wind up at the UN?
I think at this stage, no. I think the meeting this week will probably kick the ball down the road to November. That'll be after a U.S. election. And I think it's also the point which the Europeans would begin to say, if we can't get agreement on a voluntary suspension of enrichment, then it should have to go to the UN. So I think in November is probably the key time. And then I think the likelihood, if Iran hasn't suspended activities by then I think it is quite possible it would go to the Security Council.
Stephen, thank you.
My pleasure.
Stephen Fidler is chief reporter for the Financial Times of London.
Parts of south coastal Florida are under evacuation orders today as Hurricane Ivan charts its relentless path. The big blow, the third in 2 months for Florida, is expected Monday. But Ivan is already churning through the Caribbean with winds up to 145 miles an hour and at least 20 deaths behind it in Grenada, Venezuela, and the Dominican Republic. And now Ivan the Terrible is bearing down on Jamaica. From the Jamaica Gleaner newspaper in Kingston, we're joined by reporter Omar Anderson. And Omar, Hurricane Ivan is expected to hit land there probably this evening. What's the weather out your window right now?
Well, as we speak, it's quite overcast. It's raining. In sections of Kingston, there were what we call tidal or storm surges, where the seawater basically is coming onto the roadway. So those really are the effects of Hurricane Ivan.
Well, we understand residents are boarding up and are listening in, but what about tourists? Where are they supposed to go?
Well, I heard an unconfirmed report that some tourists were being removed from Montego Bay, which, you know, is tourist Mecca in Jamaica, to the Dominican Republic. That is to ensure their safety.
Well, what is expected? How damaging is this supposed to be?
Put it this way, in 1988, when Hurricane Gilbert affected Jamaica, it was a Category 3 hurricane. Now, this hurricane is Category 4. When Gilbert hit, it did massive damage to the basic infrastructure of the country. So we expect that the damage will be even more extensive, worse if it is upgraded to a Category 5 hurricane. Mm. So we in Jamaica are really looking for a very, very, very huge onslaught. And I can tell you that most companies, gas stations, stores, banks, and other business places have, you know, used a lot of ply boards and have battened down. So really, I think Jamaicans this time are taking this storm seriously. In recent times, you know, there have been, you know, some Jamaicans have been quite flippant about the prospect of a hurricane. But I think this time the news has really, really hit on.
We understand there's already been looting in Grenada. Is looting a concern in Jamaica?
It is a concern in Jamaica. And yesterday, the Minister of National Security, the Honorable Dr. Peter Phillips, he and the Prime Minister, they did put the police and the army on alert to prevent any such occurrence. So I think for the most part, you know, until the storm hits, then we can say how prepared we are. But I think if and when Ivan hits, that we should have been fairly well prepared for it.
Well, finally, there's a report in the Jamaica Observer that Jamaica's meteorologists may choose this moment to go on strike. What do you know about that?
Well, we here found the news a little strange because apparently the forecasters, they had some outstanding labor matters which were not settled, and I thought they were just using the current situation to press their demand. But I think the forecast will use their better judgment, and I think everything will be okay because they know at this time that the country is very vulnerable and that, you know, this is when their services is really needed.
Mm. Omar, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Omar Anderson is a reporter with the Jamaica Gleaner in Kingston.
The thick cloud of dust and debris that choked the streets of New York City near the World Trade Center on 9/11 3 years ago is still making people sick. Thousands of New Yorkers are suffering from respiratory problems like asthma, and many have developed a new ailment known as the World Trade Center cough. There are emotional scars, too. A new study by the Government Accountability Office says that programs to track these health problems will run out of money by 2009, long before some illnesses might ever show up. Janet Heinrich is Director of Healthcare and Public Health Issues for the GAO. And Janet, why is it so important that these programs that monitor 9/11 health problems continue?
It really is important in terms of really being able to identify diseases that take a long time to develop, and certainly cancers are one of the big concerns here. The other thing that people have expressed concern about are the long-term emotional scars from being that close to this tragedy.
Now, in terms of firefighters, about 90% of them, we're told, had an acute cough right after 9/11, and hundreds of them since then have had to quit their jobs because of 9/11-related health problems, particularly in terms of respiratory issues. Why is that such a problem for firefighters?
The firefighters were those individuals that ran into the smoke, the debris. Many of them were not wearing any protective gear, face masks of any sort. And that really is a concern. So they really had a very high dose of the debris, the smoke, whatever was in the air. They had one of the largest doses of any groups that were there that day. The firefighters as a group are required to not have any kind of respiratory problems in order to be an active firefighter.
Let's talk a little bit more about the emotional toll, especially on children. What has the research shown us so far?
The research has shown that those children that were in close proximity to the World Trade Center have higher rates of different kinds of emotional problems, some depression, some post-traumatic stress syndrome, and others are just having difficulty managing, coping with their daily lives.
What was the most surprising thing you found?
For the researchers and for us looking, you know, across these studies is that people expected the immediate problems, but they weren't anticipating the chronic problems. And we're not set up, we don't have programs to treat people if they have chronic problems and they don't have an ongoing insurance that will help cover their problems.
Well, what about that? Because the programs we're talking about here study the problem but don't actually provide treatment. So is there any real benefit to people?
The benefit, I think, is long-term in terms of understanding what the effect of this kind of exposure, which is, you know, multiple elements, has on the human body. But the fact of the matter is that the screening programs don't have an immediate provision for treatment, and therefore there is not an immediate return, if you will, to the individuals that are participating.
Are you worried that there are problems here that we will not uncover if these programs run out of money, and that's why we need to make sure that this research continues?
That's absolutely correct. We really do need to be able to monitor people with these chronic respiratory conditions as well as the emotional problems over time, and we really should be able to have systems in place that would provide care as well.
Janet, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Janet Heinrich is Director of Healthcare and Public Health Issues for the Government Accountability Office. Later in the show, new polls show President Bush widening his lead over John Kerry after a successful convention and an anti-Kerry ad campaign. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
With the third anniversary of 9/11 tomorrow, memories drift back. We were thinking, among other things, of the people of Gander. In the hours after four passenger jets crashed, aviation officials grounded all U.S. flights in an attempt to prevent more hijackings. 38 jets were sent to Gander International Airport in Newfoundland, where the 10,000 townspeople rolled out the red carpet for over 6,500 stranded travelers. Last year, we spoke to the mayor of Gander, Claude Elliott, and Roxanne Loper, one of Gander's many guests. And finally, we also spoke to Jim DeFeed, author of the book The Day the World Came to Town, 9/11 in Gander, Newfoundland. I turned first to Roxanne, who had been traveling with her husband from Kazakhstan to her home in Texas with a wonderful new surprise.
We'd been there for 3 weeks adopting a 2-year-old.
Alexandria?
Yes.
And suddenly, as if that kind of a trip isn't nerve-shattering enough, you find yourself landing in Gander. Had you ever heard of Gander before?
No, never.
Mr. Mayor, you were up there in Gander. When you first heard that you were going to have to provide some sort of home for all of these passengers, what were your thoughts?
Well, I guess our thoughts was we weren't sure if just how long they were staying. We said we better get prepared for the worst-case scenario, that they're here for 4 or 5 days, and that's when we went into action.
Yeah. Jim DeFeed, you've talked to a lot of these people. Give us your overall sense of this combination of cultures.
the people of Newfoundland have a long history of being the types of folks who come running whenever there's trouble, whenever a neighbor's in trouble. That spirit has been fostered over generations. And so, I mean, in a way, it was the best possible place they could have landed.
The bus drivers, we hear, were on strike, and they came off strike to give us the rides to our different places to sleep.
Yeah, people stayed in people's homes. You stayed in the Lions Club.
Yes, and when we got there, there were already blow-up mattresses and sleeping bags and pillows and toothpaste and everything we could need.
There's points in your book, Jim, and maybe the mayor can chime in on this. There's a point where I guess somebody with a New York accent was on the street screaming, "Did you see that?" And everybody came running, and what he saw was a truck that stopped for people crossing the street without a stoplight. He was so stunned.
We have one gentleman, when they were ready to go back aboard the plane, said we couldn't find him. And after about a 20 minutes or 25 minutes, we found him. He was in moose hunting with some of the hunters here.
And, Jim, there was a couple whose son was a missing firefighter in New York.
Yeah, that's the story of Hannah and Dennis O'Rourke. They were coming home after a vacation in Ireland, and when they landed and found out what was happening in New York City, their first thoughts went to their son, Kevin, a New York City firefighter, as you said. And pretty soon after they got off the plane, they learned that he was among the missing, and it wasn't until they got home that they found out that in fact, he had died. But it was the way the town responded when they learned that the parents of a firefighter was there in their midst that has always touched them and stayed with them to this day.
Seeing it on TV, I would get incredibly angry and upset, and as everyone would. And when they would see one particular person was Bruce McLeod, the president of the Lions Club, when he would see me get shook up, he would pull me to the side. In fact, he even threw me on his motorcycle once and took me for a ride. So they were there. They were there for us to hold our hands and give us hugs and balance things for us.
Well, Mr. Mayor, isn't it true, too? I always got this impression that while you and the folks in town were helping the passengers deal with this terrible tragedy that was taking place, the fact that you were able to do that actually helped you and the rest of the townspeople also sort through what was going on in this tragedy. You know, it gave you something positive to do.
Oh, yes, absolutely. The old community became involved in actually the tragedy that took place so far away brought everybody so close together, even in our community.
I hear, complete strangers were walking up and dragging people like Roxanne into their houses to take showers and giving the plane people, taking them out bar hopping if they needed it. And did anyone actually do a screeching in, Mr. Mayor? I guess that's a ritual in Gander. It involves a little bit of alcohol, and it has to do with becoming an honorary Newfoundlander.
Yes, it do. You get a certificate and everything to go with it.
Yeah.
And of course, you get to kiss a cod, which is something that most people don't get to do in their normal lives.
That's right.
Mr. Mayor, do you miss your guests?
After they left, it was like we had lost a family. But we still, today, there's still people coming back, and they've developed relationships that will last for a lifetime.
Well, and it's not just people coming back to Gander. I've been amazed at the number of people from Gander who have now gone visiting the folks in the United States that stayed with them. Folks in the United States have turned around and sort of said, come on down and stay with us.
It is. It's working both ways.
Roxanne, one last question. Mm-hmm. What will you tell Alexandria about her beginning?
Oh, wow. We had quite the experience and quite the story to tell her when she gets bigger. And thanks to Jim, we now have a book that we can give her.
That's the amazing thing, too, about Alexandria. How is Alexandria, by the way?
She's doing wonderful. She's just turned four.
Good.
You know, and because here, Roxanne, you think to yourself, you're bringing this child home from Kazakhstan, an area that probably would be a dangerous place for a child to grow up. And yet you were thinking, okay, now we're bringing her home to the safety of the United States. And suddenly you realize that day you're bringing her home almost into a possible war zone.
Yeah, there for a few days I was certainly questioning what we had just done.
But you don't anymore, I know.
No, not at all.
And besides, she now, Mr. Mayor, it sounds like she has a whole town that cares about her future.
Absolutely, and for every day we still, there's still a lot of turmoil in this world today, but we certainly will pray for our American friends and the people throughout the world that someday we'll all live in peace.
Well, I want to thank all of you.
Thank you very much.
Really appreciate
it.
Thank you.
Claude Elliott, mayor of Gander, Newfoundland. Roxanne Loper, one of thousands of people stranded there 3 years ago. Jim DeFede, author of the book The Day the World Came to Town, 9/11 in Gander, Newfoundland.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message, 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
Please tell us how to pronounce your name and also tell us the town you're from.
Next week on Here and Now, we look at a recent study that shows charter school students are reading better than students in regular public schools.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
A poll out today from the Washington Post and ABC News shows George Bush leading John Kerry in the race for president, 52-43% nationally. But the same poll shows both men are running about even in 19 battleground states where the election will most likely be decided. The poll also suggests that a month of attacks questioning John Kerry's war record in Vietnam has taken a toll because Kerry's favorability rating has plummeted from 51% to 36%, while the president's approval rating has gone up. How long those trends will last is anyone's guess, because George Bush's service record in the Vietnam era once again came under scrutiny on several fronts this week, and new attacks on Kerry's are in the works. Well, joining us to talk about all this are Nolan Finley, editorial page editor of the Detroit News in Michigan. Hello, Nolan.
Hey, Gail.
And Walter Robinson, editor of the Boston Globe's investigative unit, also the writer of one of the key stories this week about the president's Vietnam-era service. Hi, Walter.
Hi, Gail.
Well, Walter, I want to start with you. You had a report in Wednesday's Globe about two documents showing that George Bush had performed no National Guard service for 6 months in 1972 and 3 months in 1973. Also, that he had failed to perform other required guard duties. Some of this information had already been released. Why go back to the documents?
Well, we've been re-examining the documents for some time. We asked the White House last month to answer some questions for us, and in terms of the timing of this story, which I think has troubled some people, we would have published it last month had the White House responded. And we did call them on Tuesday and insisted that we had to have a response that day, and we did get somewhat of a response. The issue here is that in February, when this became the issue du jour for about a week or so, the White House trotted out a retired colonel from Texas who attested that Bush had fulfilled his obligation. And in fact, the records show and what he signed up to do show that he came up well short of those. And that was the purpose of our article, was to set that record straight.
And Nolan, Walter's story came out in the Globe the same day that CBS ran an interview that night with a man who has declared himself as a Kerry supporter and who acknowledged that he had helped President Bush escape the draft by getting him into the National Guard. And the network also had four documents showing that Bush had failed to fulfill his duties and that one of his commanding officers felt pressured into letting all of that slide. What's your take on these stories and also the attacks on Kerry's war record?
I don't think either one matters. I think it's certainly not an issue that is going to decide the election. It didn't last time around when a lot of this was dragged out. It didn't when Bill Clinton's service record was dragged out or lack of a service record was dragged out. Vietnam is not something that resonates with the voters, and yet it is a favorite. It seems to be the favorite topic for both the campaigns and the media.
Well, doesn't it get to the candidate's character and veracity?
What matters is what Bush has done the last 4 years, and there's plenty to judge him on. And, you know, by the same account, it matters what John Kerry's done in the Senate, and there's plenty to judge him on. That's what we should be examining and talking about.
Oh, Walter, do you think this matters to voters? I mean, what are you hearing from readers about your story?
Well, I think it does matter. I don't disagree with Nolan that the principal preoccupation of the voters and the media should be, and I actually think for the media has been, the records of the candidates. Senator Kerry has chosen to make his Vietnam record the centerpiece of his campaign. And I think there's a lot of second guessing among some thoughtful Democrats about whether that was a wise strategy. When in fact he should have been talking more about current issues like the economy, the war in Iraq, and the war on terror. My view is that biography is terribly important when we pick our leaders, particularly our presidents, and that the issue of a candidate's truthfulness is something that needs also to be assessed, and whether it's on how he conducted himself in during the last 4 years or what he wrote about himself in a published autobiography in 1999. And on that issue, President Bush did not tell the truth, and the public, I think, has a right to know that. And if they choose to pay it scant attention or consider it to be one small piece of a larger puzzle, that's fine.
Or a wash, because certainly John Kerry wasn't in Cambodia in Christmas of 68 or when he said he was, and probably didn't see all of the things he claimed he saw to the congressional committee when he came back from Vietnam. So, I mean, both sides have stretched their biographies. Both sides have polished their records. It's not atypical in a presidential campaign. I don't know when the voters put all this on the scale, whether it's going to mount one way or another to very much.
Well, to one more specific point, there is a documentary that's coming out, another attack against John Kerry next week from a Republican former Vietnam prisoner of war that says what Kerry told Congress about the war in Vietnam being a mistake was tremendously hurtful to the men who were being held as prisoners of war. I mean, is this more of the same kind
Absolutely.
Of dirty politics, or
Absolutely.
Is this an interesting new part of the debate?
It's more of the same, and it's equally irrelevant. Vietnam was a very painful part of this nation's history. A lot of people made choices as 18, 19, and 20-year-olds in desperation that they probably aren't so proud of today. I just hate to see that era dragged out and cut open again.
Well, let's get to something a little more current then. What do you think about Vice President Dick Cheney's attempt this week to clarify what he said a few days ago? He said that he never meant on Tuesday to say that if Kerry was elected that the U.S. would see another terrorist attack. And what he really meant to say was that whoever is elected president has to anticipate more attacks. Walter, your thoughts?
Well, we have a long history of candidates seeking to amend and explain their remarks, and this is clearly one of them. I think, no doubt, the Bush-Cheney campaign wishes that the vice president's remarks had been a little more artful than they were.
And Nolan, did he cross the line, as some have said?
I can't imagine there is a line anymore in politics. You've got $67 million being spent, all of it on smear campaigns. There is no line in politics anymore.
And do you think it's going to only get worse from here on in?
Can't imagine it'll get better. It never has.
I agree with that. The vitriolic response from either side to what people say or write or report is at a level that I find really disturbing. And it's really coarsened our politics, and it's unfortunate.
All right. Gentlemen, thank you both so much.
Gail, it was good to be with you.
Pleasure.
Walter Robinson is editor of the Boston Globe's investigative unit, the Spotlight Team. Nolan Finley is editorial page editor of the Detroit News in Michigan.
Still to come, Manhasset, Long Island remembers and moves on after 9/11. You're listening to Here and Now. On the eve of the third anniversary, two Massachusetts women who lost their husbands in the 9/11 attacks are on a 250-mile journey in their memory. Susan Reddick and Patty Quigley are bicycling from Ground Zero in New York to the new 9/11 Memorial in downtown Boston, and they hope to raise $100,000 for their fledgling nonprofit agency Beyond the 11th, which provides assistance to widows in Afghanistan. Well, Susan and Patty join us from the road on their trip. First of all, where are you, Patty?
We're outside of New Haven, Connecticut, kind of northeast.
Do people know what you're doing?
No. They just see three crazy bike riders with a support person behind them.
Both of you, as we said, lost your husbands. Patty, your husband Patrick was on United Airlines Flight 175. It crashed into the South Tower. Susan, your husband David was on Flight 11, crashed into the North Tower. I mean, and you were both pregnant at the time. Can you just remind us of that hell, and how did you find each other?
You know, it was crazy. It was unbelievable. People all over the United States didn't know where their husbands, spouses, husbands, wives were. And I unfortunately found out that Patrick was on one of those planes that went into the tower. And immediate support from family, friends, neighborhood, people all over the United States came into my house and helped out.
And Susan, I'm imagining that you met Patty, both being widows and being pregnant.
There were only three of us in Massachusetts who were pregnant at the time when our husbands were killed. We were both just trying to get through our daily lives, preparing for babies, having babies. As soon as we met, though, it was an instant connection. We clicked, and it's been a really amazing friendship. And once we decided to move forward with creating the organization Beyond the 11th, it's even grown.
And you have a lot of other women in your lives, Afghan women. How did you decide to make that connection with them?
When the United States was preparing to invade Afghanistan, we were overcome by the images that we saw on TV of the lives of the Afghan people, in particular the widows.
I understand that you've come to learn much more about other hardships women in Afghanistan face. Can you give me one example of something that struck you?
When these women, when they find out their husbands have been killed, their property goes to the husband's family. It does not go to the wife and the children. So in some instances, they are no longer able to stay in their house. So not only do they lose their husbands, they lose their house. They have to pack up all their things and leave.
So now your bike ride will lead to funds that will help these women. I know 200 other people are going to be joining you tomorrow in Dover, Massachusetts, for the final 30 miles. That will bring the number of bikers to 202. That's an important number.
It's a very important number for us because the memorial that was just dedicated in July in the Boston Public Garden has 202 names. They're victims that from the New England area from 9/11, and we want to represent each of those people in our ride and make sure that people understand we are all moving forward and not letting the terrorists terrorize our lives.
We're all going to congregate about a mile outside the memorial so that we will all end together. We will ride in 202 strong, finishing right around the memorial, and I think it's going to be an amazing feeling for us.
Well, Susan Reddick and Patty Quigley, we're going to let you get back on the bikes.
Thank you very much
for having us.
Susan Reddick and Patty Quigley, they formed the group Beyond the 11th. You can learn more about their work and their bike ride by visiting our website, here-now.org.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Manhasset, New York is a small bedroom community just 16 miles from Manhattan on Long Island's North Shore. Hundreds of Wall Street workers live here because it's a quick commute from the city to the old Tudor and white brick homes and the Long Island Sound beyond. During a casual walk through town last weekend, through the emerald green backyards, many delis,
you have a nice day and nice to see you again,
and Jeannie's hair salon, there wasn't one person who wasn't thinking of the 40 people from here, all of them parents,
who died on September 11, 2001.
Many of my ladies did lose their husbands, their sons. It was a very bad situation, still is. People have not recovered from this yet. Manhasset was one of the hardest hit, as we all know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's hard to forget. You know, I knew two people who I grew up with who had families now. You know, I used to play a lot of basketball with them just around the neighborhood. You know, but they were two New York City firemen. And, you know, I myself have two small girls, and it's, you know, you always think back that, you know, how does this affect these families? How does it affect these little, you know, these little people? It's always a reminder. And, you know, coming up here on the third anniversary, you know, I remember my second girl was born September 13th, and there was a possibility that she would have born on September 11th. And I understood that, you know, the hospitals, nobody wanted to be born that day. So there was a huge backup in deliveries because, you know, it has a stigma.
At the heart of Manhasset, next to the park with the white gazebo and a block from the old brick high school, is the train station. Manhasset is just a few stops from Manhattan, and town residents fill the train parking lot, so workers from neighboring towns often rent driveway space and walk to the train. I asked a passing policeman about stories of sad vigils, residents waiting in vain on 9/11 for the train to bring their driveway tenants home.
There was a lot of that around here.
Did you also have cars that were left at the train station?
Yeah, there were a lot of cars left at the train station for, you know, a long while. You know, good for a week or two, cars that had been sitting there. And I ran the plates on some of them. I knew some of them were the people that were missing.
What do you think's going to be the feeling this year?
Well, I'm not too sure. I'm hoping people, hopefully with time, you know, they're healed a little bit better.
It was so sad. You know, there really isn't a word in the dictionary how everybody felt that day.
Did you notice, as others have said, seats empty, regulars missing? Or?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we went through about 15 funerals. My regular customers that I always had fun with, spoke to, joked around, they were no longer here. They would get off the train, they would wave at us, we would talk, get a slice of pizza. You know, old towns where everybody knew everybody. You know, like the part of my heart was gone. We have the park across the street and they hold vigils. You know, the week before, you know, you look across the way and you say, you know what, you know, we're going to see these people, you know, that lost their loved ones. And you start getting, you know, a little down. You know, on the other hand, it's nice to see the turnout.
You can hear the sounds of success, of life going on in Manhasset, but I found myself listening for another sound familiar to Long Islanders, the mournful wail of the fire siren. I've been trying to communicate to friends, when you grow up on Long Island, you get used to that. It's sort of an air siren.
Well, it began with the clanging of a bell. Over time, it moved on to an air horn, which would tell the people from the surrounding areas that there was a fire. People would drop what they were doing. The butcher would leave the market. The post-up man would stop his rounds. And everyone would convene back in the firehouse.
At the firehouse, the entire department is made up of volunteers who responded to the alarm on 9/11 to cover fires in other parts of New York City. But many of Long Island's volunteers also double as paid Manhattan firefighters. Those already in the city that day died in the towers.
You know, that day it was all a matter of who happened to be on and what firehouses they were in. It was, where were you assigned? If you were in the tower that went down first, everyone was gone.
Hey, both of you, thank you so much. I think people in other parts of the country...
You've got to go off.
It being a volunteer department, people are driving up from all over town and just abandoning their cars on the sidewalk and running into the fire department, jumping into firemen's uniforms and manning the trucks. Some have business suits on. They live here. And this is what happened on September 11th.
It
it's eerie because September's coming and you see the nice fall weather and you remember that day very clearly. And it's sad because you see the wives, you see the daughters, you see people walking and you don't know what to say. Some people have moved since then. I think it's something where it's going to be something that we're going to think about forever. It's nothing that's going to go away.
Are you going to do anything this year? Is there something you are going to do to mark the day?
Ever since 9/11, I belong to a prayer group, and ever since 9/11, we used to meet twice a week. Now we meet every day, and from 9 to 11:30, we've been cranking up prayers and praying for the leaders, praying for the area, praying for the families, and often we pray for the police, the families that were wrecked as far as who went back to drinking, who went back, because they can't forget what they saw, they can't forget.
And yet, it's so beautiful here in Manhasset. It's easy for an outsider to forget how close to home 9/11 came. If I could, I see you're watering your beautiful flowers here. You know, it's a week from the anniversary of 9/11. Are you finding yourself, as someone who lives in Manhasset, thinking about that or even conscious of that?
Yes. Actually, I happen to have been at the top of the World Trade Center, Tower 1, on 9/11. I was actually trying to sneak into a conference, and the people there were registering people, and they said, is there anything I can help you with? They ushered me out, most professional of them, and unfortunately, most everybody at that conference was lost during 9/11. No, I feel obviously blessed to have survived that incident, and I feel terrible about the people I left behind.
Yeah, and obviously you're thinking about it. I mean, even though you're standing here watering your sedum, I am so sorry. You know, you just in Manhasset, you just don't know who you're gonna run into. What an unbelievable coincidence! You know that you were almost there that day.
It was. I was just outside the lobby when the first plane hit the first tower. It was a glass enclosed restaurant. All of a sudden, it was a loud bang, and the whole frame of the coffee shop shook. I saw white, yellow-hot fireball up against the glass. The explosion must have gone down some of the elevator banks and shot out in the lobby. So 17 people in the lobby were burned, badly burned.
What happens here? You know, I see everybody out watering their lawns. It's so absolutely beautiful today. What happens in this town? Do you seek each other out, those of you who were there that day, who relatives of those who were there that day?
I think in this town, so many lives were lost, and that everybody is cognizant of what happened 3 years ago, and everybody is sensitive to that. It is on people's minds. But, you know, a lot does go unspoken, and a lot does remain inside.
Yeah. And I can't help but think, as the day approaches,
you know, every single day, not a day goes by that I don't think about it, and not a day goes by that I'm not thankful to have come home to my wife, Pam, and my daughters, Delaney and Emery. And on any special occasion, like today happens to be my daughter's birthday, and on any normal occasion where life is good, you're always thankful. And then on days where it's a rotten day, you're still thankful because you're here.
Voices from Manhasset, New York. 40 people from there, all parents, died 3 years ago on 9/11.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.